The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome the program today, Alan Lenhoff. He joins us on the telephone. Where are you, Detroit area?
I'm just outside Detroit.
Okay. Alan is the co-author of a new book called Classic Keys, Keyboard Sounds That Launched Rock Music. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
This appears to be a labor of love in a way. Tell us about yourself and your interest in keyboards.
Well, this was a seven-year labor of love for me and for David Robertson, my Australian co-author. My background is primarily in journalism. Worked for a number of newspapers and sort of did the heavy-duty political writing and investigative reporting thing. But I've always had an interest in music, and I played in bands when I was younger. And so I sort of melded two interests in this book.
And this is just a massive book. I don't know how much it weighs, but it's one of these coffee table type books. I mean, it's just gorgeously designed, big format. What a project. What made you decide to collaborate on this with David? How did this all happen?
Well, you know, I had sort of an idea that at least I ought to create a book like this, but I was looking for a partner to sort of take on some of the load here. And, you know, frankly, we started out doing a much less ambitious project. Hmm. But as time went on and we realized that we were capable of something more interesting and more important and more authoritative and more beautiful, the project kept growing and we were sort of challenging each other to do more. So, you know, what it is now, it's 416 pages, and people have joked that they can use it for an aerobic workout. It's so heavy, but it's large page sizes and high quality stock, and for us it was sort of a dream come true because we both really had this interest and wanted to do it in a first class way and found a publisher that let us do that.
And really gorgeous illustrations throughout of these magnificent instruments. Let's go back now to when you first in your life became aware of the magic of these types of keyboards. What were you, like a young fan of rock and roll? Tell us how it happened.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I was in high school, I played in a bunch of rock bands, and I admired many of these instruments, couldn't afford many of them, but sort of kept them in the back of my mind, and they stayed there for a long time. After I went to college and had a long career in journalism. And, in some ways, this is the book of the instruments that I wished I owned back in the day, but really weren't possible for me.
And what were the hot bands that had the really cool keyboard setups that you remember from your youth where you'd look up at them on stage or you'd see them on TV, on a TV show like Hullabaloo or Shindig or something, you go, oh, man, is that a cool keyboard that guy's playing?
Yeah, I mean, I love the Hammond organs, and you'd see them in a lot of the British groups like Procol Harum. You saw them in a lot of American groups like the Young Rascals. Some of the combo organs, and especially when Ray Manzarek of the Doors started playing the Vox Continental organ to such great effect. There were lots of heroes out there playing some of these great instruments.
Well, you just mentioned a musician who apparently had kind of a unique keyboard setup, Ray Manzarek from the Doors. Do you want to tell us about that? A lot of people apparently want to emulate that setup.
Yeah, well, you know, he started out playing an old upright piano, and one day his record company sent him and the rest of the Doors over to the Vox showroom in Southern California and said, pick whatever you want. And he picked a Vox Continental organ, which a lot of the British invasion groups had used. The Dave Clark Five had used it. The Beatles had used it. The Animals had used it. And he sort of turned it into his own instrument. The Doors never had a bass player. They would occasionally bring one in the studio, but on stage they never did. So what Ray did was he bought a Fender Rhodes piano bass, which is essentially the lower 32 notes of a Fender Rhodes piano, propped that on top of his Vox Continental combo organ, and his left hand became the bass player for the Doors.
Mm-hmm.
In the studio, that didn't work quite as well, and they did use a variety of session musicians who came in, and you can hear on the Doors recordings. But live, he was the bass player.
And if you looked at some of those records, a lot of times they didn't even identify who the bass player was, did they?
No. Well, you know, that was sort of typical of the era. Not only did they not identify the bass player, but a lot of times groups of the 60s and 70s, they weren't good enough musicians to play on their own recordings, and they would bring in some fabulous session musicians in Los Angeles or Nashville or wherever they were recording, and those were the people that you hear on the records, and then they sent them out on tour, and of course they had to play their own music or try to play their own music.
Mm.
But that wasn't true with the Doors, except for the bass player. They were able to, they were good enough musicians to record for themselves.
In case you're just tuning in, my guest is Alan Lenhoff, and we're talking about the book he co-wrote with David Robertson called Classic Keys, Keyboard Sounds That Launched Rock Music. And you have this broken down into sections about each of these spectacular devices. And you talk about how keyboards became electric. You give us a background, a history of pianos and organs. And if we went back to a certain time in history, a piano was the thing that a family maybe in the 19th century would want, and maybe none of them could even play it, but it was just a magnificent piece of furniture. Everybody wanted a piano back in the day, didn't they?
Yeah, they absolutely did. You know, you realize that 100 years ago when there weren't recordings, if you wanted music in your house, you had to have an instrument and have somebody who could play it. You know, we obviously take that for granted now. But, you know, a lot of the underpinning of the book, if you go back to, say, the 1950s, and you think of somebody like Ray Charles, and here's a piano player and a star, but he's playing in a lot of sort of bad clubs and dive bars, and there's a picture of him in the book. He's playing in a roller rink.
Mm.
And he would go in, and whatever piano was sitting there was what Ray Charles was going to play that night. And it might be something with three broken strings and with the ivory coming off the keys, and it hadn't been tuned in 5 years, but that's what he was stuck with. And suddenly in the 1950s, you get, in mid-1950s, you get the Wurlitzer Company creating what they called an electronic piano, and it was portable. And the first ones sounded awful, but for someone like Ray Charles, the ability to carry his own piano to a gig like all his other sidemen did, they were all able to carry their instruments in and not be dependent on whatever piano was sitting at a venue for him, was just a revelation. It freed him from the tyranny of these bad pianos, and you know, he could take it into his hotel room at night and practice or write songs. So this is where a lot of the instruments in the book come from. It's the desire for two things. One is to have an instrument that you can control and you know the quality is going to be good. And the other thing is to allow you to be loud enough as music just kept getting louder.
Mm.
And miking acoustic pianos just didn't work well.
And, of course, the keyboard player was competing with the guitar players for who could be the loudest in some of these bands.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it was a losing contest for a lot of these years. But, you know, from that poor-sounding piano that Ray Charles uses, and you can hear it on his famous recording of What I Say, you have an evolution of keyboard instruments that go to today's instruments, which are digital and can emulate any instrument in an orchestra. And if you go to a movie today, it's quite possible that the soundtrack you're hearing that you think is an orchestra is really being performed entirely on a single digital keyboard. So the story of the book sort of spans that time from those first portable instruments that end up being used on stage in rock and jazz and blues bands to today's incredible digital instruments that can trick you into thinking that they're anything. They're portable digital orchestras.
Let's look at some of these iconic instruments and talk about some of the visionary people who were responsible for their creation. I think the Hammond B3 really stands out as an amazing device. And the guy that created the company, what a story.
Lawrence Hammond was an inventor and created all sorts of things. One of his inventions was a barometer. He invented an automatic transmission for a car. But one of his key inventions was what he called a synchronous motor, which was a very precise electrical motor. And he used it for a while in a 3D movie system that he created. And then he created kind of a sustaining business of building clocks with this precise electric motor. Pretty soon in the 1930s, the clock business was not a good business to be in because there was a lot of competition, and he was looking for some new sustaining thing to do, and with the help of some people who were far more musical than he was, in the 1930s he created his first Hammond tone wheel organ. And the B3, which is really the model that is the standard for jazz and rock and still found on stage, debuts in 1955, and it was produced for 20 years. But like I say, if you go to a concert today, you would still see it very widely used.
And these are highly sought after because they only made them for 20 years. And we look at a musician like Jimmy Smith, who I think is probably as identified with that instrument as anybody, and how he influenced so many other players.
Now, well, virtually every top rock Hammond organist has a Jimmy Smith story to tell of how he influenced him. John Lord of Deep Purple used to say it was hard not to emulate Jimmy Smith when he was doing his solos. So, that was a great influence that a master of jazz had on a generation of rock players.
I think anybody that ever encountered Jimmy Smith has a story because I've even heard them.
Yeah, absolutely true.
Yeah, I heard he was kind of wild.
Yeah, well, he was known for being a little cantankerous.
Yeah.
But, sometimes when you have the talent, arrogance follows and people can accept it, I suppose.
Yeah. You mentioned Wurlitzer earlier. Now, isn't Wurlitzer the manufacturer that was behind the keyboards that were played at silent movies back in the day?
Yeah, the mighty Wurlitzer organs were well known, and back in the 1920s and 1930s, you go into one of those ornate movie palaces, and there was probably a Wurlitzer pipe organ there that could emulate all sorts of instruments, and somebody would hit a button and it would make sort of a ooga horn noise, or it would make a gong, or it would make piano-like sounds. And they created a wide variety of musical instruments, but they were nowhere near contemporary music until the 1950s when they first produced this electronic piano that I mentioned that Ray Charles and others played. Ironically, it was never meant for the stage. That electronic piano was intended to be an inexpensive, compact way for a child to learn to play. Huh. And one of the things that was touted about it was it could be played with headphones, so mom and dad didn't have to be bothered by hearing their 6-year-old kid, make mistakes as they're learning to play.
You're listening to the Book Nook. We'll be right back. My guest is Alan Lenhoff. His book, Classic Keys, Keyboard Sounds That Launched Rock Music, written with David Robertson. You're listening to the Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, your home for independent news and handpicked music. And I got to say, when I look back and I'm watching an old video of a 1960s band, say from England, and they're up there on stage, and man, that Vox Continental sure looks good. Let's talk about this instrument.
Yeah, the Vox Continental was an attempt by a British company to essentially make a portable Hammond organ. And when you think about the B3 weighs nearly 300 pounds, and people were trying to take it to upstairs clubs, two flights of stairs, that didn't work. So the idea was to put Hammond-like sounds in a compact package that you could throw into the trunk of your car. And the development of transistors in the 50s, although they didn't build this until the early 60s, was a critical element in allowing them to make something more portable. But I sort of wish we could show you a picture of it now, because it's a very stylish, futuristic design with a bright red lid and a chrome stand, and it looked futuristic then, and it still does.
Uh-huh. I agree. And fortunately, you've got all these wonderful photos throughout the book, and all this material from manufacturers and pictures of inventors and pictures of musicians and lots of quotes from musicians. Was it hard getting musicians to talk to you, some of these famous ones?
Well, sometimes it's easier than you'd think, because they have a reverence for some of these instruments that they either played back in the day or in many cases still do. And so there's a sort of reservoir of goodwill, and we did find there was an interest in talking about it, and a number of people like Rick Wakeman, yes, and Donald Fagen of Steely Dan, and others, were quite happy to endorse the book too.
I was a big fan of Straub's and of Yes back when Rick Wakeman was in the group, and he really put on a show.
With a cape and a stack of keyboards.
He sure did. And the whole progressive rock thing. Well, I was a huge prog guy, and I hated to see that die out as it kind of did.
Yeah, well, many of the instruments in here were very important to progressive rock. You had a lot of, especially the British musicians who are classically trained, and so, you can hear them playing the Hammond, and one of the instruments they really got into was the mellotron.
Uh-huh.
They could add orchestral sounds to what they did.
I think a lot of our listeners have no idea what a mellotron actually was, and this is one of my favorite sections. I love the fact that the mellotron factory had a young employee at one point who ended up becoming the mellotron player for the Moody Blues, and this really helped him out, because you talk about a finicky instrument. Describe what exactly a mellotron is.
Well, a mellotron could accurately be described either as a musical instrument or a machine. The mellotron, when you press a key on the mellotron keyboard, you're actually activating a tape player, and it will play a recording in the pitch of the key of whatever tape you happen to have in there. So it might be the tape of a flute or a group of violins or oboes. But sometimes they even did odd things, like you can get a tape where you can hear the sound of somebody rubbing the rim of a wine glass, or you can hear car horns.
Mm.
You could make that tape any sound you want. But what made the mellotron special in a lot of ways was how imperfect it was. It really had low fidelity sound. I mean, the best example I can give is it sort of sounded like a bad 8-track tape. It had a wavering pitch, and, players described it as being dreamy or haunting sounding or mystical or awe-inspiring. If it had realistically reproduced the sounds of a symphony orchestra, it wouldn't have been nearly as special as it was. And, if people want to think about what this sound is, you can think of the Moody Blues, Nights in White Satin, which is full of mellotron, or the haunting flute, B3 beginning of the Beatles' Strawberry Fields Forever.
And
you hear that sort of wavering, and the pitch is not quite right. Players had a lot of problems with it when they tried to play live, because it was a very troublesome instrument. You mentioned Mike Pinder, the Moody Blues, who actually worked in the Mellotron factory before he formed the Moody Blues. One of his greatest assets as a Mellotron player was his ability, if it failed, to realign all the tapes and lie on his back and work his way through all this mechanism to get the thing to work, whereas a lesser player might have said, can we find an organ for tonight?
And they were very fragile. So when the roadies were loading the gear, it was very easy to shake them up and dislodge something or make them so that they just wouldn't function.
Yeah. Well, the book is full of stories of really horror stories about the Mellotron and people talking about the power supply bursting into flames and melting all the tapes, or you know, falling off an airport conveyor and destroying the instrument. And there was a point in almost every band's beginning when they played the first chord on a Mellotron, and it was either going to work or it was going to make some horrendous sound that meant it wasn't going to be usable that night.
Mm.
But the alternative was to hire 20 or 30 moonlighting symphony musicians to make those orchestral sounds that they wanted in their music. So the Mellotron filled that role for them well, and they tolerated a lot of difficulties with it.
Gotcha. They got to be very collectible. My guest is Alan Lenhoff, and he's the author, co-author of Classic Keys, Keyboard Sounds That Launched Rock Music, along with David Robertson, who lives in Australia. Let's hit one of these other iconic machines, the Rhodes piano. That's a biggie.
Yes. Harold Rhodes essentially invented that piano when he was in the Air Force during World War II. And Harold, before he was in the military, was a music teacher. And he started teaching officers in the officers' club how to play piano in his spare time. And at one point he was asked, he said, there were a lot of recuperating soldiers in hospital that could use some diversion, and could you teach them to play? So he had to invent a small piano that a soldier in bed could put in his lap and play. And so Harold Rhodes went out and he salvaged spare parts from old planes and made a piano that sort of sounded like a toy piano.
Uh-huh.
And his method was used during World War II to teach probably more than 100,000 wounded soldiers how to play piano. After that, he was always looking for an opportunity to improve on what he had done and also to find a commercial outlet for it. Finally, in the 1960s, he teamed with Leo Fender of the Fender Guitar Company, and then they began to sell these first pianos, which by this time had evolved into a beautiful bell-like sound that jazz guys loved. And you could hear those early Rhodes pianos on a lot of Miles Davis recordings with Chick Corea and Herbie Hancock and some others. And then the rock guys came in and the pop guys came in, and there are so many iconic songs where you can hear that beautiful Rhodes piano song. One of them I would mention is Riders on the Storm by The Doors. You can hear it on The New Kid in Town by The Eagles. Michael McDonald of the Doobie Brothers is playing it on Minute by Minute.
Uh-huh.
Lots of Stevie Wonder. You hear it on Living for the City.
Sure.
Jazz, in a lot of ways, is still one of the favorite places for it. And a classic album that shows off the Fender Rhodes piano is Chick Corea and his Light as a Feather album.
Uh-huh.
The ethereal sounds of that.
Yeah, Miles Davis, you give him credit for really kind of giving greater exposure to the Rhodes.
Yeah, and not only the Rhodes, but other electric instruments. He was just fascinated with electric instruments, and he would often acquire them, and a Chick Corea or Keith Jarrett or some of the other top jazz players would come into his sessions, and he'd say, in a grumpy sort of way, "You're playing that." Pointed them at something they had never seen before,
uh-huh.
and they really wanted to work with Miles Davis. So they walked away from the grand piano they would have preferred to have played, and played whatever keyboard instrument he pointed them at.
That's funny. You would refer to him as a grump, because then you mentioned also in that same explanation the name Keith Jarrett, who I think of as about the biggest grump that ever sat down at a keyboard. Have you ever seen him play?
No, I've not seen him live.
Ooh, don't make a noise. Don't make a sound. My guest is Alan Lenhoff, and the book is Classic Keys, Keyboard Sounds That Launched Rock Music. There was something in here, and this might have been written in a section by your colleague here, but there was something in here that was so fascinating to me that I want to mention it, and it was this device called the telharmonium. I had never heard of this. This is the most incredible thing. Are you able to talk about that at all?
Sure. The telharmonium was a predecessor of the technology that ends up being used in the Hammond organ. And the idea is that you have what later became known as tone wheels that spin, and as they pass a magnetic pickup, they create an electrical impulse which can be amplified and turned into sound. And in the early 20th century, one of the first telharmoniums was installed in a theater in New York, and it was so big that it took up the entire basement of the theater, and there were no loudspeakers at that point. It was basically transmitted to listeners by something that was akin to telephone
uh-huh.
technology.
And you could subscribe to it, supposedly. Thousands of people could be listening to it all over the city.
Right, that's correct.
And this is back in like 1900.
Yeah.
That's
and then 30 years later, with the invention of more electronic devices, Lawrence Hammond comes around and takes some of this technology, does it more better in a more practical way, and there's your first Hammond organ.
Oh, my. I'm assuming, Alan, that you've got your own collection of instruments, things that you really treasure and that are prizes for you. What's your favorite one? Is there a particular keyboard that you own that is your numero uno favorite instrument, the one that you're the most delighted to possess?
Well, you know, I think it's probably the Vox Continental organ.
Uh-huh.
I have a 1965 Continental, and it was built in Dartford, Kent, England. And, you know, about 1 year later, this is after the Beatles have come to America, and Vox instruments are all the rage in the U.S. because the Beatles played them. They started building those organs in Southern California. And then shortly after that, they started building them in Italy to save money on labor. And there are differences between the organs, depending on which country of origin it is. But basically, they all sound the same, and they're all wonderful machines. But, you know, in my way of thinking, there's something special about having the same model of organ that the Beatles played and that the Animals played on a song like House of the Rising Sun. It just feels special to me. And, most of these organs, they were meant to be gigged.
Mm.
And they were really abused and beat up. But somehow I found one that's in very nice condition. I spent a lot of time fixing it up electronically. So that's my favorite.
Nice. Well, I've been doing this show for a while, and back in the day, probably 20 years ago, I had Ray Manzarek on the show, and he was talking about a novel. I wished I'd asked him more about playing with the Doors. And I'm sure if he was still alive, you would have loved to have asked him some questions, too. Also, you just mentioned the Animals. I had Eric Burdon on one time, He wasn't talking about keyboards. He was a little different. And I've got to say, this is quite a book, and we've barely scratched the surface. There are so much in here that we didn't talk about. There's a chapter on the Hohner Planet, the Farfisa Compact, the Gibson G101, the Hohner Clavinet, the RMI Electropiano, the Yamaha, was it CP70B, and the Moog, the Mini Moog. Ooh, I wished we'd had time to talk about that, but hey, we'll leave that for readers to discover in this book. Classic Keys, Keyboard Sounds That Launch Rock Music, co-written by Alan Lenhoff, who's been my guest today. Do you have any parting words of advice or wisdom or observations you'd like to share with our listeners here in Southwest Ohio?
Well, I think that for folks who read the book, you should realize that these instruments aren't museum pieces. They're still loved today, and many of them are still played widely in the studio and on stage. And even when they aren't, if you go today and see a digital keyboard, the odds are it has what they call patches of each of these instruments because the sounds of them are still so well loved. So, you know, even though some of these are instruments of the 1960s or 1970s, they'd be very familiar to people who are listening to today's contemporary music because those same sounds are in there.
And Alan, as a former newspaper guy, it sounds like that was really your passion, too, for many years. What do you think about the current situation with newspapers? And newspapers like your paper in Detroit.
Yeah, well, it's an extremely difficult economic situation. And in some ways, I feel fortunate not to be part of that business today. And, you know, I had some great times there, including not too far away from you. I worked for a Cincinnati newspaper.
Oh, did you? Which one?
I worked for the Post, which is no longer.
Oh, sure. Business. Uh-huh.
And, you know, America needs great journalism, and it's become more and more difficult to sustain that economically because there is no substitute for feet on the street and getting talented people to work for you. And so I have significant amounts of concern about many of these papers, especially, you know, outside the national newspapers, the metropolitan dailies and you know, how they will survive and how well they can serve their communities.
Well, don't have to look any further than, say, the Cleveland Plain Dealer to just go, oh, my, that is really sad.
Yeah, well, it's a different world today. And everybody is adapting to it, for better or for worse, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it's really been a pleasure talking to you about your book, Alan. Thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you, Vic. Appreciate it.
My guest has been Alan Lenhoff. He and David Robertson wrote this beautiful book. It's called Classic Keys, Keyboard Sounds That Launched Rock Music. And it would look good on a coffee table. It's a big one, full of illustrations and full of information. And I learned a lot, and a lot of it I didn't understand because I'm not a musician. And a lot of it just went right over my head. But fascinating, I'm sure, to any musician who reads it, who understands some of this stuff. And also the technology. Wow, you've got all kinds of technical information in here. I was very impressed.
Well, you know, people can relate to the book in different ways, and you know, people can thumb through it and say, look at the beautiful pictures, or look at the pictures of the rock stars and things like that, or I didn't know that instrument was played on that song. Or if you're really into it, you know, you can find quite a bit of detail about the technology that made these instruments possible.
Well, it's all here, and you're right. It's so great to be able to read the lists of songs where a particular instrument was played. You mentioned the Mellotron on Strawberry Fields Forever and on those Moody Blues cuts and so many other things, and just fascinating to me. And thank you so much for your time, Alan.
Thank you.
And this is an amazing book, Classic Keys, Keyboard Sounds That Launch Rock Music. And if you'd like to check out some of the stuff that's in the book, they do have a website, and their website address is classickeysbook.com. And if you go there, you can check out a lot of information and illustrations from the book and see just what an amazing big book this is. And we've got a little extra time this morning on the program. I'm going to bring you a special Best of the Book Nook bonus. We're going to dip into our archive momentarily and pull out a rabbit. That's coming up right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO with a special bonus segment. And I went into the archive and pulled out an interview that I didn't even remember doing until I listened to it. And I said, oh, man, I've got to replay this one because it reminded me of when I was very young and I was fascinated by trivia and by weird things, hoaxes and just the strangeness of life and the peculiarities of history. And back in 2000, I interviewed a guy named Clifford Pickover. Look him up on Google, Clifford Pickover. You'll be amazed. He's a scientist. At the time I interviewed him, he was working for IBM, and he had just written a book called The Girl Who Gave Birth to Rabbits, A True Medical Mystery. Check this out. It's the best of the Book Nook with Clifford Pickover.
Cliff, how did you get the idea to write this book? I had never heard of Mary Toft.
Yeah, Mary Toft is the star of the book. She's the girl who appeared to give birth to rabbits. We can set the scene. She was about 25 years old when this actually did take place, and the year was 1726. But maybe before we get into her story, my interest got stimulated in all this when I started researching hoaxes and medical hoaxes and strange happenings with animals. You'll see a lot of odd animal things in the book. And one of the stories that really got me down this road was a story from 1953, a true story where someone in Georgia bet his friend $10 that he could get his photo in the local newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And what he did was he took a monkey, one of these small monkeys, and anesthetized it and killed it and shaved the hair off of it. And he put it on a highway and took his car and sort of braked hard so it leaves streaks in the road as if he hit this object. And when the police came, this guy, his name was Ed Waters, was walking around and talking about glowing lights in the sky and aliens and how these creatures came out. And he won his bet with his friend. He did get in the local newspaper. In fact, the Air Force and the Georgia Bureau of Investigation and TV all got involved. So from these stories like this, which are, not as influential as The Girl Who Gave Birth to Rabbits, I started getting interested in all sorts of hoaxes. And this is The Girl Who Gave Birth to Rabbits actually took place, and even the King of England got involved. Apparently, rabbits were coming out of her. All the medical people of the time, or many of them, I should say, were firmly convinced that she was birthing rabbits, and they studied her, and it was a very interesting story. Of course, today we're pretty sure it was a hoax, and perhaps she concealed rabbits or pieces of rabbits in a specially designed pocket in her dress. We're not 100% sure what happened, and there's a lot of debate, but the interesting thing is how she could fool very learned people at the time.
Now, what was her motive?
We're not sure about her motive also. We could speculate that she did it for attention and money. She was pretty poor. She was married to her husband for about 6 years and had two living children. And, they had a very tough life. This was in England, south of London. And she appeared to give rise to a real miscarriage, we think, in August of the year 1726. And it was September that she gave birth to her first creature, which looked almost like a cat. And, some historians speculate that maybe this miscarriage almost gave her this idea for getting attention. And when she was forced to confess at the end of this ordeal, it went all the way to about December, with her constantly giving birth to rabbits, she sort of blamed, other people, her mother-in-law giving her the idea, all sorts of things, but it looks like attention and money were certainly part of the scheme, and maybe just got out of hand. She didn't realize that she would actually be brought to London and exhibited and studied and all the rest. And she actually eventually wound up in jail because they thought she was defrauding the public.
In case you've just tuned in, my guest in the Book Nook is Clifford Pickover. His book is The Girl Who Gave Birth to Rabbits, A True Medical Mystery. We all stand in the checkout line at the supermarkets, and maybe we don't buy them, but we can't help but look at some of those tabloids with headlines like Woman Gives Birth to Alligator Child or Woman Gives Birth to Duck Boy. We're fascinated by the bizarre, aren't we?
Yes, for people who think that this story, you know, doesn't have much relevance today, or, you know, it happened back in time when medicine and science wasn't sophisticated, I think that's not really right. As you're saying, you know, the Weekly World News and, you know, many tabloids have all sorts of stories about strange animal births. You know, in some sense, people may not take it seriously, or, you know, things like urban legends and alligators and sewers, it doesn't really, you know, hurt anyone too much. But, you know, some serious hoaxes can destroy a whole line of scholarship, in, you know, even particularly in medicine. If people go down the wrong track with hoaxes in medicine, it could stop them from getting, you know, good traditional treatment.
You have a chapter called Why Animals and Sex, where you warn the readers that this might amaze some and disgust others, and you really pull out some amazing information in this chapter, also some really incredible illustrations, and I frankly love this chapter.
So even if it amazes and disgusts you, it probably would interest many of the people listening to the radio show, yeah.
It's pretty amazing stuff. Did you really have to go far afield to find this type of information?
Oh, I researched, you know, the literature pretty extensively, and in this particular chapter that held your fascination, you know, I go back in time to the Romans and Greece, where bestiality and things like that took place probably more than today. I go into African tribes, and I recall one of the oddest things were these fishermen, I think, somewhere in East Africa. Have carnal knowledge with these 500-pound marine mammals called dugongs. They look a little bit like walruses or huge seals, and it was amazing. But it seems like this sort of thing went back to the dawn of humanity. There are pictures in caves where cavemen are shown having sex with elks, and the Incas had llamas, and so it's rather strange. And then that, you know, takes us from animals to people who seem to have weird compulsions for swallowing things. Not, you know, not only do people give birth at one end, but people were, you know, ejecting things from their mouths. There was one woman in Germany in 1642. She was known as the frog vomiting woman from Germany, where she would just vomit these amphibians. And so I have all sorts of strange things in here.
Was that Henriette Fenning that did that?
Well, there were
a number of them.
Few people. There was another guy in southern Germany who, you know, vomited newts and frogs. And
Theodora's Dotterlein.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yes, southern Germany. And there are stories of people who, you know, go the other way. There was a 42-year-old woman in 1927 who went to physicians complaining of a slight abdominal pain.
Oh.
And the physicians found exactly 2,533 objects in her stomach, including 947 bent pins. So I don't shy away from some of this stuff. But, you know, there is a more serious side to this. And, you know, I think one reason the book appeals to people is that Mary Toff's case, you know, has a lot of things that resonate with us today. You know, it talks about justice and morality and crime and punishment. You know, what is science and superstition? And, like, just say Monica Lewinsky, and she seemed to cast a bad light on our present American politics. Well, back then, Mary Toff was sort of the Monica Lewinsky of the 1700s, where she cast a bad light on the physicians of the time. You know, we got to see doctors as very self-serving, caring about their reputations and their fame, and probably if it happened today, the Internet would go wild with her story.
And there's just a total fascination on the part of the population and the media with both cases, so you have the parallel.
That's right. The media went utterly wild back then. It was people talked about nothing but this for a few months, and it was in all the papers, and even the scientific treatises that the doctors were writing up, you know, went into many editions for people to read, and it was really something that people just talked about all the time. And as I said, even the King of England himself, you know, got to meet her and examine these rabbit-like children that some of the physicians proudly exhibited in jars, and they studied with dissection and all the rest.
Well, I learned a lot of new words, and I had heard of geophagia before, people who eat dirt. I understand this is still done in some cultures. I also learned a word that I had never heard before called pseudokin. We won't get into what that is, but this is just a fascinating book. And I can remember as a kid enjoying the Guinness Book of World Records and Ripley's Believe It or Not, and this really fed that same kind of desire to learn about strange things.
Right. I had a fascination. Well, you know, one definition of pseudokin, we could talk about these are these mole-like animals that they believe Dutch women gave birth to when they were too close to hot stoves. But there's some variants of that definition that people will just have to read the book to get the nitty-gritty on.
I'm guessing you probably liked reading Philip Jose Farmer as well.
Yeah, he was a favorite, and I quote from one of his science fiction novel where snake-like creature seemed to live inside a woman's womb.
Mm-hmm. This is really an amazing book, and I must say, I read it, and it was one of these books where I just started glancing at it, and the next thing I knew, I was reading it, and then I couldn't put it down. The book is The Girl Who Gave Birth to Rabbits, A True Medical Mystery by Cliff Pickover. Cliff, how do you have time to write these books?
Well, I'm an efficient guy, and as I tell other people, some people are golfing on the weekend or, you know, having a rich social life. There I am instead behind my keyboard typing away. So I guess it's giving up something and getting something else, you know.
These illustrations that you have so many of them, and the woodcuts of the European beast, 16th through 17th centuries. These are really cool.
Yeah, I'm a very visual guy, so I always like to load my books up with illustrations, and these are all very interesting historically. And, you know, I also have some odd creatures. There's one that I recall, I have a nice illustration of. It's a creature that someone claimed to find in the 1970s. It said he was attacked by it. While he was swimming, and, you know, the CIA supposedly took away his first one. And today we know that he fabricated this creature out of something like a stingray.
Is that the sea eagle?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And there's some other names it goes by, right? And, you know, you can cut the tail and move it, and the sort of the nostrils where the creature breathes in, the water goes in and out of the creature's body look like eyes, you know, from a certain viewpoint, so it's very easy to fool someone. So people are interested in hoaxes, the history of hoaxes. This book is probably for them. And also for people interested in strange collectors, people who collected, had bizarre museums of, you know, specimens of all types. This is a book for them.
And that was one of our truly classic interviews. Going back to the year 2000, 20 years ago, I interviewed a guy named Clifford Pickover. And was that fascinating and strange and bizarre? You have to agree with me that that was just so weird. The Girl Who Gave Birth to Rabbits, A True Medical Mystery. And I had completely forgotten that I did that interview. And Peter, my engineer, was digitizing some old interviews for me. And I had not written anything on that one. I didn't have anything written saying Clifford Pickover recorded in 2000. And so it was a real treat and a real surprise to have that little rabbit pop out of the hat there. And hope you enjoyed that. And if you're into listening to podcasts, I know a lot of you are, when you're busy baking loaves of bread out there and you're working in the kitchen, podcasts are really great things to listen to, aren't they? Well, we have hundreds of them, author interviews going back to the early 1990s, archived in our Book Nook archive at wyso.org. Go to the Book Nook page, hundreds of hours of interviews with authors. And not many as weird as that one by Clifford Pickover, but some very interesting stuff. So check it out at wyso.org. For the best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes. I hope you're being safe out there. Thanks, as always, for listening.